So this is a break from tradition, really, what I'm doing here, because normally perfect speech comes after perfect emotion, and perfect action comes after perfect speech. So I'm kind of breaking from tradition by swapping it around. The sense is that what Eric has introduced us to is the skillfulness with which we perform our actions, the consciousness with which we perform our actions of body, speech, and mind. And I wanted to kind of follow the talk on speech from the basis of what Eric has introduced us to, which includes awareness of speaking. From when we look at consider perfect speech or perfecting speech, it's considered under four areas of truthful speech or honest speech, of kind speech, of helpful speech, and harmonious speech. And these have all been referred to in your talk. So in this vision and transformation that Erica referred to, Sangharaksha says, speech is something in which we have to engage all the time. And in the Ten Pillars, he says, the Ten Pillars of Buddhism, he said, for the vast majority of people, the stream of speech is so constant and so uninterrupted and so much under the influence of unskillful mental states, many of them unconscious, that all four speech precepts are likely to be broken many times every week. And as Erica was saying, we are perfecting these stages rather than them being perfect. We are perfecting them by practicing, by making them conscious, by trying to be more aware of what we are communicating. He also says speech is something special, something extraordinary, something which really does distinguish us from all other forms of life. And it's therefore natural and inevitable that in the moral and spiritual life we should give such consideration to speech, give as much consideration to speech as we do to thought and action. When you're ordained, or when I was ordained into the Buddhist order, we take on to practice 10 precepts. So there's three of the body, which you've alluded to in your talk. There are four of speech and three of mind. So what Sangharaksha says here is very much borne out in the fact that we have four speech precepts to practice, and three of body and three of mind. So I became acutely aware post my ordination, and I struggled for years to practice the four speech precepts of abstaining from false speech, abstaining from harsh speech, abstaining from useless and frivolous speech, and to cultivate instead truthful or honest speech, kind and helpful speech, and harmonious speech. I struggle because they seem kind of nebulous in the predominantly semi and unconscious profusion of thoughts and the stream of words that uttered from my mouth. It seemed very difficult to kind of navigate my way to be able to cultivate truthful speech, kind speech, helpful and harmonious speech. That was until I read a book called Nonviolent Communication, A Language of Compassion, by the late Marshall Rosenberg. This was in the early 2000s. And while I was reading this book, I realised that I was being given a method by which I could practice the speech precepts more effectively and more consciously than I had done. The model's not perfect, because I don't think Marshall Rosenberg was enlightened, but that's not my judgment at all. He moved to Chicago when he was a young lad from another part of the States, and he moved there at a time when there's lots of race riots going on. He was a Jewish boy. So he came into this environment as a young Jewish boy in a conflicted society. And he was puzzled from an early age, how come some of us lose our compassion and trying such situations and others do not. And how come we create so much conflict through speech? End up doing a PhD, and the non-violent communication process is the consequence. So we teach best what we most need to learn. That's a phrase from Richard Bach's Adventures of a Reluctant Messiah. So this is what I'm doing, really, teaching something I most need to learn, because I haven't perfected speech myself. So if you're willing, I'd like to share with you tonight how this non-violent communication, or I experience it more as metaphor communication. That's putting it in the positive rather than the non-violent, which is the negative formulation. Marshall Rosenberg refers to it as compassionate communication, but I actually think it's more metaphor communication. By explaining the four steps of the process and how they may well provide a framework for yourselves in terms of communicating truthfully, kindly, helpfully, and harmoniously. So, the model has four aspects of observation, feeling, need, and request. However, communication always involves people. And that's something that Sangharakshi talks about in this particular imperfect speech. He says that communication always involves two people. It doesn't involve yourself, it always involves another or other people. And so this model involves oneself, applying the model to oneself and to another person or other people. And as Erica said, communication always starts with the intention, from this model's point of view, always starts with the intention to connect with the person that you're speaking to. Which means bearing the person in mind, being aware of them, as Erica was saying with Anthony, being aware of the person that you're speaking to, and are you aware of the mindset that they might be in, what they might be feeling? Yeah? Often, I've noticed by observing this in myself that one of my predominant tendencies is when I speak to someone, I usually speak with the intention of asking them to do something for me. Or ask them to get because I want something from them, not because I want to connect with them as a person. Or I might communicate what I'm saying because I want to prove my point. I want to get my way. This seems to be, from my own experience observing others, these two are quite common. You know? When we communicate with someone, our intent is to either prove our point, get our way, or get them to do something for us, you know? Rather than to connect with them as a human being. So it's kind of bearing our intention in mind before we communicate. What's my intention in communicating? Am I intending to connect with a person, or do I want to manipulate them in some way to prove my point or get something done from them? And the other kind of focus is to keep your attention in the present. Because when you're connecting with someone in the present, you're connecting with them as they are now, not who they've been or who they might be. And I'll explain this a bit more later. So, truthful speech involves communicating what is. It means being accurate with what we're speaking about. And the same thing applies with the first stage of observation. It means expressing what you actually experience, you know, rather than adding your little story to it. You know? So often we'll see something, but when we talk about it, we elaborate it with adjectives, we add our own little bit to it, we personalise it, and we kind of remove the object or the thing from its own reality. You know? We personalise it, we tell a little story about it, we elaborate it. So Marshall Rosenberg was talking about practicing learning to listen and hear, to see and to remember in the way a video camera would record an event. So the video recorder records what's actually being said, and it only records what's being seen. The video recording doesn't elaborate it with our own personal interpretation of things. So this is quite a practice. You know, it's quite a practice to communicate what you actually see and what you actually hear. I do quite a bit of work with couples, and often couple A will say, will say such and such, and when that person B hears that, they've completely turned what person A said into their own story. They've interpreted it and completely missed the point of what was first being said. So what I often do is I invite them to sit back to back, and I give them something, and I ask the first person to describe what they're seeing to the other, and ask the other to hear what they've heard. Yeah? And even that simple process often gets elaborated and interpreted and somewhat confused. Yeah? So there's a sense of honesty, living to practice what we're speaking, what we're seeing, what we're hearing, what we're remembering as clearly as we can, rather than personalising it or elaborating it or minimising it or exaggerating it. And often, for most of us, what we're observing, what's happening around us, what's happened or what might happen, affects the way we feel. And feeling, I've written primary here. Marshall Rosenberg tends to do what most of us do in the West, is mix feelings and emotions and express them as though they're the same thing. In the Buddhist tradition, we distinguish between feeling and emotion. Feeling's what we feel through our senses. What we see produces a feeling. What we hear produces a feeling. What we think, taste and touch and smell produce feelings. Yeah? And so when we hear or see something, it often triggers a feeling in us. Yeah? And what most of us do is we attribute the cause of that feeling to what we're hearing, seeing, remembering. Yeah? And the difficulty is if we attribute what we're feeling to what's happening, we kind of don't take responsibility for how we're feeling. We attribute that feeling and cause to something or somebody else. And what often happens when we do that is we then can justify our behaviour towards the person or the thing that's caused how we feel. So if I feel annoyed, if I feel irritated, if I feel angry, what I tend to do is attribute that to what's happening or what's not happening. Yeah? And in doing so, I cease to take responsibility for the fact this is my feeling, this is how I'm feeling. And so what Marshall Rosenberg has kind of, I think, quite cleverly articulated is that if we attribute our feeling to a human need that we're experiencing that's either been fulfilled or not, we can then take full responsibility and do something about that. You know? Whereas if we attribute what we're feeling to what's happening, to what's happened, what we're hearing, what we're seeing, then often what happens is we actually produce conflict here. We get into conflict with the person or the situation that we're attributing our feelings to. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So if you think about it, most of the conflict that happens because of this dynamic. Yeah? We attribute what we're feeling to something outside ourselves. And if we don't like the feeling, then we can justify our behaviour back to that personal thing, which creates conflict. Yeah? Hence, Marshall Rosenberg has called it non-violent communication. Yeah? So what we're practicing with this model is learning to communicate in a way that's non-violent, yeah? And as we'll see later, also compassionate. That's why I call it, I tend to see it as more metaphor communication. Let me just have a pause here. He's also identified that from observation, a lot of the words we use to describe feelings are not actually feelings. So I work in the mental health field, and one of the words that's very common in the field I work is the word abused. It's a very commonly used word to describe how I feel, abused. There's also words like neglected, ignored, rejected, abandoned, annoying. So if you think about these so-called feelings, which I don't think are feelings, and I agree with him, they're actually behaviours that we attribute to another person. You think of the word abused, it's not how I feel. I might feel hurt, I might feel pain, I might feel scared, I might feel afraid or fear, but I don't actually feel abused. I don't feel rejected, I feel isolated, I feel alone. So I quite like the distinction he's making there between what you actually feel and what you're attributing to somebody else's behaviour. Because again, you're actually making something outside yourself responsible for how you feel. In the Buddhist tradition, we talk about that we use the word vedana to describe feeling. So vedana is what we feel in response, as I've said, to what we're seeing, what we're smelling, tasting, thinking. And that feeling is on a spectrum between unpleasant and pleasant. It's quite simple, really. And then what we can't distinguish as pleasant or unpleasant is as it were neutral. It's not intense enough to feel clearly. So I quite like this idea here, is that to distinguish what we actually feel from what we think we feel and what we attribute to somebody else's behaviour. So he said you can describe a feeling in three words. I feel happy, I feel sad, I feel lonely, I feel upset, I feel joy, I feel bliss. Often when I hear people talking about feelings, they say something like, I feel like I, and then they can tell a story about what they're feeling. They haven't described their feeling, they've described their thoughts about what they're feeling. And often that thought is a narrative about the other person or about what's happening. And it's through feeling, it's through me connecting empathically with another person's feeling that empathy arises, that a real connection happens through the level of feeling, not through thought, but through feeling. That's how we connect with each other, through feeling. When we can connect with how somebody else feels, we feel there's an energy between us which is quite tangible. So when it comes to need, Marshall Rosenberg, this is I'm also breaking tradition here by introducing somebody else other than Sung Rinpoche. Sung Rinpoche has endorsed this work. So, what he means by need is human needs. Needs we all share in common as human beings. They're transpersonal. They're not my needs. They're needs that we all have as human beings. In fact, we all have them as living beings, but particularly as human beings. So I've used this model here of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where we all share the need for breathing, air, water, sleep, money, etc. They're all physical needs that we all share. And then there's the needs for safety, for security, for well-being. And then there's a sense of because we are social beings, there's needs for sort of social connection. And then there's the kind of psychological needs for well-being, and then there's the spiritual needs, which Maslow obviously didn't have the sense of enlightenment, so enlightenment's not included there, but I would imagine self-actualization, as it were, is the process of enlightenment from which the perfections come. So if we attribute what we're feeling to needs that are being met or not, rather than to something outside ourselves or to another person, we can then do something. We can take responsibility for working out ways to meet that need. So what we do is we take responsibility for what we're feeling, and then we use the feeling as an indicator to whether the need for security is being met, the need for communication is being met, the need for enough money to buy food this week is being met. If I'm feeling anxious, that might be that I've got a bill to pay that I haven't got the money for. If I'm feeling happy, it might be because I've got the money to pay the bill. So the feeling relates to the need being fulfilled or not. He suggests that feelings are simply what's alive in you in the moment, And that will be a similar thing with a Vedana. It's not skillful or unskillful, it's just what you're feeling. There's no skillful or unskillful about it, it's just what you're feeling. You know? There's no judgment. And so if we can identify what the needs are that are operating, that relate to the feeling, I can then do something about that. I can take responsibility for that. And because the needs are transpersonal, you know, there's that sense of when we relate to another person's need, we can do that through kindness and awareness. So he says, all actions are attempt to meet needs. I quite like that. Every action is an attempt to meet a need. That doesn't mean to say that every action meets the need, but it's an attempt to meet a need. It might be that on the basis of greed, hatred and delusion, the way we go about meeting the need might not be that skillful. You know? But if we can see it, if we can relate to others on the basis that every action is an attempt to meet a need, we can therefore be compassionate with each other when we make mistakes in the process. You know? And we can also celebrate their joy when the need that they're attempting to meet is fulfilled. So Marshall Rosenberg says, when we understand the needs that motivate our own and others' behaviour, we have no enemies. We have no enemies when we understand the motivation, what motivates us and others. What motivates our behaviour. There's a very compassionate component to this model of communication. So once we've identified what the need is, we can then make a request of ourselves or another person or other people to contribute towards us fulfilling that need. And he says that the request needs to be doable. There's a woman in Germany that described the non-doable need as a holy wish. And with the client work I do, I quite often work with parents, and unfortunately parents quite often make lots of holy wishes towards their children and their partner by saying, listen to me. I have a situation that I experience quite often where my partner will say, can hang up the washing? I said, yep. And then in my mind, I'll do that when I've completed my task. You know? She'll come back up later on and say, you haven't hung the washing yet. Yet. Says, I'm going to, but you haven't done it. And I said, I'm going to. So a holy wish has been made. Yeah. If she had said to me, can you hang out the washing within the next 5 minutes? I would have said, no, I will not hang it. I'm not willing to do it within the next 5 minutes. I'm willing to do it within the next half hour or within the next 2 hours. Yeah. So a doable request is person-specific, time-specific, action-specific. And he suggests that the first request we make is, are you willing to tell me what you've understood by what I've just said? And that way you hear what the other person said. Because as I said before, often what happens is we don't hear what the other person says. We hear something and then we get triggered into our own story and we create a different reality from what we see. It's coming back here. It's practicing, you know, really listening to what's actually being said rather than creating your own story about what the other person said. So I find it really valuable, and he uses the phrase, would you be willing? So there's an invitation, would you be willing to do this for me within this time frame? Yeah. And if you're not, that's hunky-dory. He suggests if you can distinguish between a request and a demand by how you feel if the other person says no. Would you be willing to hang out the washing within the next 5 minutes? No, I'm not willing to do that. Chances are a demand's been expressed on the basis of an expectation that I will hang out the washing. You know? So again, the feeling that the anger that the other person feels is being attributed to my behaviour, you know, rather than how they're feeling. You know? So doable requests, you know, in order to fulfil needs that we have. You know? If one person is not willing to do it, because these needs are common as human beings, there'd be a whole bunch of other people that I could ask if they'd be willing, and someone will say, yes, I'd love to do that. So this is the kind of the intent of the request, the spirit. And I suggest from my own experience and from others, this is quite idealistic. Huh? Please only do what I have requested if you can do so with the joy of little children feeding hungry ducks. Please do not do as I have requested if there is the slightest bit of fear, resentment, guilt or shame motivating you. That will be too costly for both of us. Yeah? So, a request is distinct from a demand. And a demand is usually based on expectation. So years ago when I moved in with my partner, I was aware coming home some nights, I was aware of the expectation that when I got home there'd be a meal on the table. Because I'd lived in communities for many years and when we got home there was always a meal on the table. So moving with my partner, I had the same expectation. But I was late, there'd be meal on the table. Sometimes I come home and there's no meal on the table. And so I was aware that what I was feeling was based on an expectation that I had that this person would meet a need that was unexpressed by me. Yeah? Pure an expectation, yeah? An assumption. And so requesting is, I think, quite a skillful act. Yeah? It involves being aware of the other person when you make the request rather than being telepathic. Because often requests are telepathic, aren't they? We assume the other person will know what we want them to do. So a request is not telepathic. It's based on a connection with the other person, and you're making it on the basis of a connection with them. Yeah? And they are mutually satisfying in the sense that the example that Erica gave, yeah, if she was willing to respond to the request to give the talk with her heart, Sujiva would have been most gratified by her saying yes, and she would have been delighted by the fact that she was going to give a Dharma talk. You know? So whenever we meet somebody else's need, you know, or the need that somebody else has, then our needs are met as well. You know? As Marshall said, in the giving, a need is fulfilled in us. And in the requesting, a need is fulfilled in us. So, from that point of view, I think it's a metaphor communication process. If you say yes when somebody requests something of you, and you do it with a sense of resentment or resistance or tension, there's always going to be a comeback somewhere, isn't there? There's going to be a conflict that will arise at some point later on. And so this is applying the process to oneself. And when we're applying the process to another person, we're really trying to connect them with what their experience is, yeah? What's happening to them. How often when you communicate something to somebody, do they respond with their story? Oh, I remember that time when my father did blah, 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 blah. And it's like you're talking about your father, and then suddenly you get their story about their father. And you're thinking, but I was trying to communicate a story about my dad, you know. And, you know, this and this and this happened. And then you're telling me, and it's like there's a disconnect, isn't there? And so this is about practicing listening to what another person's story is. And then connecting with how they're feeling. And often we say, how are you feeling? And they say, I don't know. So Marshall suggests guess what they feel and keep guessing until you connect. And when you do, there's an energetic response between you. Yeah? When you really connect, when someone connects with how you're feeling, it kind of intensifies. There's a sense of joy, isn't it? When someone really gets your experience, it's quite enlightening. It's quite it's quite liberating. Yeah? And often we don't do that. You know, often when I was starting this in the early days, I'd say, you know, are you feeling sad? No, I'll withdraw. You know. You feeling upset? No. You know, so you take it personally rather than keep on going. So you're feeling anxious? Yes. So when you get that yes, you know you've connected with how that with you're connected with your experience. And then you can then because you don't know, I don't know what I don't know what Sarah thinks and feels. I have no idea. I can only guess. I don't know what Anthony's feeling right now. I can only guess. None of us know what anybody else thinks or feels. We can only guess. Often in relationships we assume we know because we've been around them so long, but the reality is no one actually knows what anybody else thinks or feels. We can only guess. And therefore guessing what somebody's feeling is really important. And I had the good fortune to learn this model from Marshall Rosenberg in London in 2003, and because we came from New Zealand to do it, not specifically, they allowed us to go on a deepening day the following day on Sunday. And on the Sunday there was a whole bunch of people there who had done the introductory course, and quite a few of them were my kind of colleagues in the order. And what was fascinating is when we came to empathise with another person's experience, most of us were kind of floored. We didn't know how to connect with another person's feelings. And let alone that, we had difficulty expressing our own feeling really clearly. And so this is a really important part of the process, is learning to really connect with another person's story of their life, trying to connect with how they're feeling, and then trying to connect that feeling with a need that they might have in this particular situation. And then supporting them in the process of a request that you might like to help fulfill a need that they've got. Have I got time to read a little poem? So this is called A Fable of Listening. A king sent his son off to study in a temple of a great master with the aim of preparing him to be a great person. When the prince arrived at the temple, the master sent him off to the forest alone with instructions to come back when he'd learned all the sounds of the forest. When the prince returned to the temple a year later, the master asked him to describe all the sounds he could hear. The prince said, "I could hear the singing of the birds, the sounds of the leaves, the breeze touching the grass and the buzz of the bees, the noise of the wind cutting the skies." When he'd finished his report, the master asked the prince to return to the forest to hear whatever else there was to hear. And even though the prince was puzzled, because he thought he'd heard all the sounds there were to hear, he returned to the forest. And for many days and nights he was alone listening, listening, listening. And he could not distinguish anything new from a part what he'd already told the master. However, on a particular morning, the prince started to hear some vague sounds, different from everything he'd heard before. The more he paid attention, the clearer the sounds became. A beautiful sensation came over the boy, and he thought, these could be the sounds the master was requesting I hear. And without hurrying away, he stayed patiently listening and listening. He wanted to be sure. When he returned again to the temple, the master asked if there was anything else that he could hear. With respect and patience, the prince said, "Master, when I paid attention, I could hear the unbearable sound of the flowers opening, the sound of the sun rising, the warmth of the earth, and the grass drinking the dew of the night." The master smiled and said, "To listen to the unhearable is to have the necessary calm to become a great person. When you can listen to the heart of others, their mute feelings, their unconfessed fears, their silent complaints, only then will a person inspire trust around them and with understanding meet the real needs of everyone. The death of relationships starts when people listen only to the words pronounced by the mouth without paying attention to what's going on inside the other. Listening to their feelings, their desires, their real opinions. Listening to the unhearable is to listen to the most important part of another human being." Thank you.